need somebody.
Help.
Not just anybody.
Help.
You know I need someone.
Help.
When I was younger, so much younger than today.
I was trying to remember my sermon title this last week. Patty shot me this email. She's like, "Hey, I need your sermon title for the bulletin." I'm like, "Oh no, I'm out." I was out at like a water park, and I got my phone. I'm like, "I don't have any idea what my title of my sermon is supposed to be," but I knew it had the word "help" in it. And then that Beatles song came into my head, and I just kept singing it like the rest of the week. I'm like, "This is totally my sermon, help!" Like calling out to God for help when we are in trouble, calling out to God for help when like our world turns upside down. So you know, a little Beatles for you. So. You know, we need help in all kinds of variety of ways, little ways, big ways. Yesterday, I was in Orlando, Florida with my family and some of their family on a vacation. And my in-laws, they've started doing this pretty intense workout regimen called CrossFit. And they said, "Hey, why don't you come with us? We think it'd be really fun for you to come." And I said, "Sure, I'm in pretty good shape, you know." So the guy asked me when we got there. He's like, "So were you in pretty good shape?" I'm in pretty good shape, yeah. So he gave like the normal workout to everybody. And then he came over to Cassie and myself and he said, "I'm going to give you guys an easier workout." And I was a little offended, to be honest. And he kind of explains what we're supposed to be doing. And he walked away and Cassie and I were standing there. We're like, "Seriously? Like, this is going to be nothing." And then he comes back over and he explains a little bit more. And I'm like, "Oh, okay, we misunderstood. Maybe this will be all right." And I'm telling you what, like halfway through, I was calling out for some help. Like, I can't tell you the last time I did so many pull-ups and push-ups and squats. My legs are dying. My legs right now are in that position where, like, if you start to sit down, like, you get a little ways and then you can't stop yourself anymore. You just fall. Because I got, like, no strength somewhere in that middle section, right? You're calling out for some help. But sometimes when we need help, it's a little more serious. On February 27th, back in 2008, Cassie, my wife, she heard a knock on the front door of our house. And this was a house that we believed that God had really put us in. We're really excited to live on this street. We had lived there for 7 months, and we sensed already that God had given us access into this close-knit group of neighbors that were on this street. And we were praying for them, and we were being like light in the darkness to them. We were shining Christ to them. People were opening up about their struggles. And I mean, these were all non-Christians. They all loved hanging out with each other, and they all partied like crazy. And here God put Cassie and I right in the middle of it. So, you know, we'd been celebrating birthdays at this place, a couple major holidays. And when Cassie opened the front door, she's standing there in her robe in the morning, and there's a real estate agent and two people standing with this real estate agent, and they're the new owners of this house that we're living in. It turned out that our landlord had been lying to us from the very beginning, and he'd been quietly shopping this house, and he found somebody to buy it, and he sold it to them. And they were coming not to look at it to buy it. They were looking at it to talk about how they could remodel it. I mean, where do you turn when your world is turned upside down? And we all have those situations. You know, they could be something that's not all that serious or intense, or something that like totally turns your world upside down. Where do you turn when trouble comes? Psalm 3 is a psalm where David is in some major trouble. His world is turned upside down. And we can learn a lot from what he does in this situation. Now, to set the context of what is happening in Psalm 3, I'm going to read and explain some verses from 2 Samuel chapter 15. I didn't put these on the screen behind me, and if you have a Bible, you could look at that if you wanted to. But I'd actually just rather you listen to the story and try to engage your imagination and to engage with some of the emotion of what's going on in this story as we try to put ourselves in David's shoes and to feel what it would be like to be David. So what's happening here in 2 Samuel is this. In the course of time, Absalom, one of David's sons, provided himself with a chariot and horses and with 50 men to run ahead of him. So Absalom decides, "Hey, I think I need a chariot." puts a bunch of horses in the front of it, and then he gets 50 men. That's a lot. And they run in front of the chariot everywhere he goes. This is a move of Absalom trying to show himself of being really important, really something. He would get up, this is Absalom, he'd get up early and he'd stand by the side of the road leading into the city gate. And whenever anyone came with a complaint to be placed before the king for a decision, Absalom would call out to him, says, "Hey, well, what town are you from?" And then he would tell him, "Hey, listen, you know what? Then they'd say, "Well, your servant's from one of the tribes of Israel." And then Absalom, he would say back, say, "Hey, look, your claims are valid and proper, but there's no representative of the king to hear you." And Absalom, then he would add, "Well, if only I were appointed judge of the land, then everyone who had a complaint would have my ear." Also, whenever they would approach him to bow down before him, Absalom would reach out his hand, he'd take hold of it, and he'd kiss him. And in this way, Absalom turned the hearts of all the people of Israel toward him. Now, so far, this has been mostly about Absalom. But David, Absalom's father, is the king. And Absalom is doing all of this, like, you think somewhat secretive stuff, but I mean, he's standing out in public, sort of talking to people, saying, "Hey, come and listen to me." He's insulting his own dad by saying, "Hey, you're never going to get a real hearing from the judge of the land." He's got his own chariot with 50 men running in front of him. He's going around the land acting like he's the king himself. And so then, after he does this for 4 years, 4 years this has been going on, he's built up enough popularity, he's built up enough what he feels like momentum behind him. He goes to his dad and he says, "Hey, Dad, listen, I want to go over to this other city, Hebron, and I want to take a bunch of people with me because I need to make a vow. I need to fulfill something that I did over there." And David says, "Sure, go ahead." And what he didn't realize is that Absalom's going to go over there and he's going to appoint himself the king of Israel. He's going to have all these people that are going to be there with him. And they're all going to say, "Absalom is king." A messenger came and told David about this plan. And this is what the messenger said: "The hearts of the people of Israel are with Absalom." Can you imagine the betrayal? The people that are supposed to love you are now saying they want to love and follow somebody else. "The hearts of the people are with Absalom." His own son has stirred a rebellion against him. So then David, I mean, what do you do in that situation? You going to fight? Do you pull your son in and try to scold him? Do you stir up your own army and have a civil war? David decides to run. And he says to those who are still loyal to him, he says, "Come, we must flee, or none of us will escape from Absalom." So on the run, fleeing for his life, being betrayed by his own son and the people that had loved him and had been loyal to him, in that environment and in that angst, David writes Psalm 3. So if you would, turn in your Bibles to Psalm 3 and let's look at what he says and what he does in his pain. And I think what we're going to see here is that there's some lessons we can learn. A model, in essence, of what David does in his trouble that we can follow in our troubles as well. Psalm 3, verses 1 and 2. "Lord, how many are my foes? How many rise up against me? Many are saying of me, 'God will not deliver him.' He's got foes everywhere around him. And the people are saying, God won't deliver him this time. So now you can even hear like the echoing of all these people doubting, oh, David, you've been rescued many times from many hard things, but this time your luck has run out. Your strength in God is gone, and God is not going to deliver you yet again. Can you think about some dangerous threats that maybe you're facing today? What are some challenges that you've got before you? I mean, is it maybe a hostile work environment with some coworkers or a boss or a work culture that's unethical? Maybe some financial troubles that relate to work or just your personal life. Maybe it's your children. I know it's family worship today, so maybe you don't want to look at your children, but maybe it's your children causing you hardship. Whether they're still in your home or whether they've moved out and they're on their own. Maybe it's family or spouses and there's conflict that is that's unresolved. There's conflict that is tearing you apart. Maybe it's neighbors. Maybe it's yourself. Dealing with doubts, dealing with your own failures, dealing with your own insecurities. Maybe it's some sort of a physical hardship of some kind that's like weighing on you. It was unexpected. It's certainly undesired, and you don't want it. It's a hardship. Because I think what we see from this first verse as David lays out his heart to the Lord is that he very honestly acknowledges his hardship and his situation. That's the first step. Some people, and certainly, I mean, I've done this, you've done this, we kind of live in a sense of, oh, everything's really great. Like we try to convince ourselves that everything's fine. We try to convince ourselves that everything's going along pretty well. But in reality, there is pain in our hearts. There's conflict that we would love to have resolved. And while that's hard to admit sometimes to ourselves, what we see here with David is this openness to just say, hey, you know what? This is my issue right now. This is my issue today. This is my pain. And so I really want to just ask you, if you would, to, in the safety of just sitting where you are, no one's going to ask you to articulate this. We're not going to have a big share time later where you have to share this with somebody else. I just ask you to identify, and like, what is it that's distressing you right now? What is it that's a danger that you're facing that is overwhelming you right now? Something that you're fearful about. Because the first step of getting deliverance out of that is just to honestly acknowledge it. And see, after we look at, see David here in this passage, after he honestly acknowledges his pain, he doesn't just sort of stay there and go like, oh, woe is me, this is horrible. Let me find some friends where I can kind of commiserate about this for a while. Have you heard? This is the worst thing ever. Have you ever had rebellion happen to you? This is what's happening to me. Well, how many did you have rebel? This is how many I have. Like, he's not doing that. After he's articulated honestly the pain, he then has this pause. You can see in your scriptures there, it says that word Selah. That's like in the rhythm of the poem and in the rhythm of the song, it gives a pause for reflection. And I think what we see there during that pause is that David shifts his perspective away from his circumstances toward God. Look at verses 3 and 4. But you, Lord, are a shield around me, my glory, the one who lifts my head high. I call out to the Lord, and he answers me from his holy mountain. So what David does is he first acknowledges honestly what's going on, and then the second thing he does is he remembers God's truth. So he's hiding, he's in some sort of a cave, he's on the outskirts of town, and he's remembering and he's reflecting and he's thinking about who God is. It doesn't even show us that he's turning to wise counsel. He's not like yelling back retorts. See, the people just said, oh, David, God's not going to rescue this time. He doesn't like yell back at them and say, oh yeah, he is, just wait and see. He's quiet enough to just say, hey, you know what? I'm going to take this to heaven. And so he turns his eyes and his heart to God. And in these verses, what I think we see is that David's reminding himself of God's truth. And then he's claiming this victory before he's even delivered. Look at that in verse 4. He says, I call out to the Lord and he answers me from his holy mountain. He's not delivered yet. Nothing has changed about his circumstances. But he's so like caught up in his vision of who God is that he's living as if he's already victorious. Let me go through a couple of things a couple of words in these verses to give you an idea of what's going on there. In verse 3, he talks about God being the shield that's around him. The word for that shield in the Hebrew is called megen, which was a small shield that they would wear on their arm, and it would basically protect their arm and their upper torso. It was a very common shield for a warrior. But it would also allow them quick mobility, because they could hold it and they could run. But see, better than just this small shield, look what it says about it. You, are, O Lord, are a shield around me. So he's taking this concept of this shield that you would hold in his arm, but it's not just the small shield, but it's actually a shield that would go in front and behind, and on both sides, and the top and the bottom. Like, it's totally encompassing him. There's no danger or threat because the shield is everywhere around him. And then the next little phrase in there, he says that, okay, Lord, you are my glory. Which seems a little bit strange because, okay, if you're in trouble, it makes sense that you would call out to God for help and deliverance. And okay, a shield is great, right? Make a shield. How about a tower? Towers are great. Put a tower around me. How about a big wall, right? It'd be a big wall that covers me, right? But how about like my glory? Like, why is he saying that? Because he recognizes that God himself placed David into the position of king. David was just a normal boy, living a normal boy's life. And God came along and said, I have other plans for you, David. He picks him out of that family and he places him in the household of the king. And he says, David, you are the new king. You are the anointed king. And David waits his time and then he is placed into the formal position of authority in the land. He recognizes that it is only because of God and God's glory and God's power and God's plan and God's anointing that he is in the position of being the king. And it is to reflect the glory of God. It's to show and reveal how amazing God is. And David, in essence, is reminding himself of that in this verse. Look, God, you are my shield and you are my glory because all of it comes from you. And I wonder, like, how can we do this for ourselves? Like, what are ways that we could call out to God in ways like when we're in trouble and when we're in difficulty? Like, how can we, like, in essence, do what David does here? One of the things that comes to my mind is a practice that I've learned years ago is the alphabet of praise. Basically, because it's praising God as you go through the different letters of the alphabet. So I can do this, you know, sometimes in my time of prayer, sometimes in like just the time of like worship, I'm just playing the guitar. I told you guys that's one of my favorite things to do when I'm just playing the guitar at my house. But it's a time when you're thinking about attributes of God, reminding yourself of things that are true of him. So it's kind of a little game I play. Like, can I actually get through the whole alphabet? So A, he is almighty. B, he is a banner of love that is over me. See, he is the crucified one. He is the Christ. He is the cornerstone. D, he is my deliverer. E, he is enough. He is Emmanuel. F, he is faithful. He is a friend. G, he is God Almighty. So you just go through the alphabet as far as you can. If you can't get a letter, you skip it. That's fine. Some of them are really tough, by the way. X is a really hard one. I don't like X. But you go through it and you're just reminding yourself of the truths of who God is. So that what happens is that your attention shifts from all of the dire circumstances that are before you, all the things that are causing you all the stress and all of the pain. And what happens is that you have this mysterious presence of Christ that changes your perspective. It changes everything about you, even though you're still in the midst of all of the trouble. That's what David is experiencing in this psalm. Nothing has changed for his physical threats and his enemies, but his heart is in a totally different situation. I think of a man named Tom White, who was imprisoned in Cuba as a spy, when in fact he was not a spy, he was a Christian missionary. And because Cuba was a communist country and it was a closed country, his plan was that he would fly his small plane over the island of Cuba at a low altitude, and he would shove out these huge trash bags filled with gospel tracts so that the people could read about the goodness of Jesus Christ. And so he'd done like 3 trips, and the Cuban authorities were really mad about this, as you can imagine, because the land would just be filtered with all of this gospel news. And of course, as a communist nation, they were not allowing that kind of information to go out. Well, on one trip, there was a huge storm. He got disoriented, and he thought the land in front of him was in fact a different country, and it was Cuba. And he landed his plane. His plane is immediately surrounded by the authorities, and he's taken away to prison. And they interrogate him and they torture him as a spy. One of the things that he tells about was that they put him in his concrete cell, and they would turn on the air conditioning to the lowest temperature it could go at the highest fan speed that was possible. He said he tried to jump to create body heat, jumping jacks, push-ups, anything he could do to try to fight the temperature. But there was no way he could raise his temperature enough in his body to combat the cold in the room. The only possible relief that he found was to go into the corner of the room, which was the least sort of windy, and he would stand, he'd put his hands behind his back, and he would slightly lean forward so that the only part of his body that was touching a wall or a surface were his feet or his forehead. Because if he sat down, the concrete would suck the heat out of his body. If he laid down, you can imagine, he's got now half of his body touching the concrete, it would suck the heat out of his body. I mean, he was so cold, he thought he was going to lose his mind anyway. And so he would, in this leaning position, he would just go in and out of consciousness, sleeping, waking. He didn't know if it was day. He didn't know if it was night. He didn't know when it would end. He didn't know if it would ever end. And then they'd pull him out for interrogation. And then they'd put him back in his cold cell. As he was in that environment, he said, "I quoted every Bible verse I could ever remember learning. I sang every Christian song and hymn that I ever learned. And I reminded myself of the unlimited power of my Savior, Jesus Christ." And he said that it was as if the presence of Jesus was tangibly in that cell with him. Just like you can sense the presence of the people around you right now. In the middle of horror, God was delivering him. Not because his circumstances changed, but because his perspective changed, his focus changed, and God changed his heart in the middle of it. You know, we're not facing challenges like Tom White, but we can experience the rescue from our problems just like he did, just like David did. By honestly acknowledging the problems that we're facing, and then to remember God's truth and to see how God will deliver us. So let's look at verses 5 and 6 and see what the result is of reminding ourselves of God's truth. It says in verse 5, "I lie down and sleep. Think of the peace that's in that verse right there. I lie down and sleep. I wake up again because the Lord sustains me. I will not fear though tens of thousands assail me on every side. I mean, honestly, this is a bit of it's a shocking sense of peace that we see here. Tens of thousands are surrounding him. They're hunting him. They want to kill him. They want to take everything that he has away from him. And in the midst of it, he's able to lie down and go to sleep. And he has no fear because he's completely trusting that whatever happens is going to be the Lord's plan. Because remember, the circumstances haven't changed. But in the middle of it all, he's experiencing God's blessing. And that's exactly what this guy Tom White experienced, right? And so just like him, in the middle of the trouble, like that's what we can experience as well. Because the natural transition is that we remember God's truth and we celebrate who God is. We put our focus and we put our mind on that. And then the natural result is that our hearts are aligned to God's truth. Our hearts are aligned to that instead of the things that are around us. See, when we're focusing on all the things that are around us, like the circumstances, the hardship, the trouble, the problems, the difficulties, our hearts get aligned to that, and it creates anxiety. It creates worry and stress, and we're freaked out. And so what David's doing is saying, all right, first of all, I honestly acknowledge, man, I got a big problem. Second of all, I'm just going to remember all this truth that I know about God, and then his heart is aligned to that truth. And that's when he experiences peace. That's when he experiences rescue. Now, after he's done all that, in verse 7, he's going to lay out his request. I think that's interesting. Verses 1 through 6 are kind of laying this foundation of him connecting to God, acknowledging his trouble. In verse 7, that's when he says, okay, I have a prayer request. Can I share my prayer request, please? But it's not even until verse 7. And he says, arise, Lord, deliver me, my God. Strike all my enemies on the jaw. Break the teeth of the wicked. So he's saying, arise. The idea there is that he's imagining that God is this mighty warrior. We'll get to the part about breaking the jaws and the teeth in a second. Hold on. But he's imagining that God is this mighty warrior who's going to come and deliver him. But before he does that, he has to get up. And he has to get on the move. He has to act now. This is not a casual kind of a prayer that you might pray repetitively for your dinner. It's not a bad thing to do that, but that's not the kind of prayer that this is. This is not the kind of repetitive prayer that you might say before you go to bed at night as a ritual. That's not a bad thing necessarily, but that's not this kind of prayer. This is the kind of prayer that says, okay, God, I need help, and I need it now. And he's not being disrespectful about it, but what he's basically saying is like, get up and move. Arise. Deliver me, my God. He's making his request to God. And then he says, obviously, something that seems strange to us, strike my enemies on the jaw, break the teeth of the wicked. So let's put this in context. Remember, David's a warrior, right? David has, from a very young age, learned how to fight wild animals, and then he transitioned and he started to fight God's enemies. That's who he was. And so what he's envisioning here is that God is an amazing warrior who could go into the midst of these 10,000 enemies of his, and he could, in the middle of that chaos, and in the middle of being totally outnumbered by the odds, is that God would go in there and he would hit his enemies on the jaw. And he would hit them so hard that he would break all their teeth. He would destroy them. He would conquer them. He would overpower them. And that's a little strange for us, because we don't usually hit people. I mean, we're taught not to punch and to fight. But for them, like a sword or a club or a weapon was just as common to them as a computer for us. It's what they used. It was their day-to-day activity. It was a very common thing. And they understood God as a God who could and would defeat his enemies. And man, David is just calling out to him saying, look, I need you to rescue me. I need you to defeat my enemies. So I don't think it means that we would ask God that he would strike our enemies and break their jaws. I think that it means that we would and make a modern day request that makes sense in our culture. That we would recognize, hey, listen, I need you to deliver me now. So here's what I need. Here's my request that I'm laying out before you, God. I ask you to rescue me. I ask you to give me your peace. I ask you to give me victory. I ask you to give me healing. I ask you to come to my rescue. Do you do this when you're in trouble? I think this is one of the things that people do most often when they're in trouble. Even people that don't believe in God will often pray to God when they are in big, big trouble. I encourage you to think about ways that you can be turning your burdens over to the Lord. Remember earlier I asked you, like, what is something right now that you're thinking about that weighs heavily on you? Think about something that is stressing you out, something that's troubling you, a dire circumstance that you're facing. And I would just encourage you to find some way to actively be putting your attention back to God and writing down your requests, going on a prayer walk or a prayer jog, and letting your heart pour out to God and lay out your requests to him. Perhaps you want to put it on a note card and talk to God about it as you drive around town. Perhaps you want to bring that prayer request to a friend and have them support you in prayer, laying out the requests really clearly. Because it's important for us to lay out the requests, but I do think it's important also that we recognize the order of what's happening here. Because the true miracle of we see in this psalm is not necessarily that he's delivered from his enemies, but the fact that his heart was aligned to what God wanted his heart to be in the verses before. Because we are not promised earthly deliverance from all of our problems. There are going to be challenges that we face, hardships that we go through. It doesn't always just end happily ever after. There's a reality to pain and suffering in the world that we will experience and that we will see. Our promise is that on the other side of this life in heaven, God makes sense of it all. Our promise is that in the midst of the suffering and the hardship, that God is with us to sustain us. Our promise is that he will be close and he will hold us up in the middle of it. And that's the miracle that we see in this passage. And then he wraps up this passage in verse 8 by saying, from the Lord comes deliverance. May your blessing be on your people. From the Lord comes deliverance. Again, he's reflecting on what is going to ultimately happen, that God is going to give him deliverance of some kind. Does he know what that deliverance is going to look like? He does not. Does he know when it's going to come? He does not. He doesn't know if it's going to be by a big storm. He doesn't know if it's going to be by some other kind of a strange circumstance. He doesn't know exactly how it's going to happen. But he's claiming this victory and saying, from the Lord comes deliverance. And I think what we see in this psalm, there's a number of steps we've seen through here that he's acknowledging honestly. He's remembering God's truth. He's being aligned to God's truth. He's making his request. And then I think what we see in this last one, because we see this a lot with David's prayers, is he's then reminding God of God's own truth. Do you ever do that in your prayers? Where you say, hey God, you know, you said this. Now, I just want to remind you that that's something that you said. David does that in the Psalms all the time. He does that through 1 and 2 Samuel all the time. He'll remind God of something that God has already said. And remember, in Psalm 1 and in Psalm 2, both of those psalms have the theme of blessed is the one who walks down the path that God has laid out for him. And what we see here is that David is tying that in. He's saying, hey, remember, God, you said, blessed is the path. Blessed is the one who walks that way. And I'm reminding you of that now because I need your strength. I need your deliverance. I need your power. I need your goodness now. And remember, you said it, and I'm going to claim it. You said it, and I need to remind myself that you said it. And I don't know if you need to be reminded, but I'm going to tell you that it's there. And he does that all the time in his prayers, reminding God of his truth. I wonder for you and for me, like how we can put this into practice, like before we even leave today, like turning back to him some area of struggle, some area that we're in hardship about, some area where we would love to see the Lord come in and completely change. I wonder if the Lord would meet us as we call out to him. I wonder if he would meet us in the middle of that anxiety and that stress, disappointment, and that our hearts would just be realigned back to where he wants it to be. As we end, I'd like us to just turn to the Lord in prayer. And I'd like to give you the moment, just a little bit of room to pray privately to him. You can just close your eyes. And I would just invite you to honestly acknowledge whatever that challenge is or hardship is that you have before you now. As you honestly acknowledge it, just even as well add detail to the Lord, like tell him how it's making you feel. Lay out to him the fears that are rising up because of it. Articulate the uncertainty that's filling your heart because of it. And then, let's align our hearts to him by just thinking these attributes that is, I just kind of claim them out about who God is. God, you are the Lord of Lords. You are the Lamb who was slain. You are the one who is the Most High. There is no one like you. You are omnipotent. You know everything. You have every power. There is nothing that you can't do. And there's nothing that you don't know. And in your presence, there is peace. And there is protection. You are the God who reigns on high. And we celebrate you this morning. We cling to you in the midst of uncertainty. And in the midst of hardship, we proclaim that you are holy. You are highly exalted. There is none better than you. You are our Savior. And you are trustworthy. And you are worthy of all of our praise and all of our fears and all of our life, Lord. We give it all to you. Do ask that you deliver us. Deliver us today and fill us with your peace.